Richard?
Yes.
You wouldn't want a backup recording, would you?
No. It goes into the ethers, that's enough. The Rosicrucian philosophy was given to us through Max Heindel in the form that we know primarily as the Rosicrucian cosmoconception. And it was made public for a specific reason. And great care has been done to fulfill that reason. And it has been done to present the Rosicrucian philosophy in a way that would be the most effective for dealing with the problems of humanity in our time. Now, the Rosicrucian cosmoconception was timely. It was itself a product of the times, and it dealt with the problems of the times. The elder brothers of the Rosicrucian order foresaw the rise of science and of technology, and they saw all the dangers that were involved with that. When you put materialism together with science and technology, it makes for a very difficult time for people to advance spiritually. And they have turned out to be perfectly right. Because in all of the countries where materialistic science and technology have held sway, spirituality and religion have been marginalized. In Northern Europe, the churches are almost empty. In China and Russia, it's very hard to find a church or a temple anywhere. Now, the cosmoconception openly states right at the very beginning that it is meant to give questions to answering minds so that those minds can be stilled, they can be stilled with confidence, and the individual can learn to follow the heart, purify the heart, listen to the intuition of the heart, and thereby build or maintain some kind of a spiritual balance and wholeness. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy has been very wonderful in giving an abundance of answers. Some are answers to questions that haven't even been asked yet. And it's presented with simplicity. And simplicity is very important for avoiding the pitfall of science and technology, the pitfall of getting too technical. Because when you get too technical, you can lose your way and you can miss the central things. Everything in the cosmoconception was stated as simply and clearly as possible. In fact, it's so clear that it produces an illusion in people. People read it and think they know it because the intuition assents to it and they say, wow, I know this. But if you know it, you should be able to live it. Hints are given in the cosmoconception of more complex things, of more specific things, and of deeper things. Now, it's been a century since the publication of the cosmoconception, and the danger of materialistic hyper-technology is even greater now than it was then. Therefore, if we are earnest Rosicrucian students, it behooves us to beware of those dangers in the manner in which we live our lives and in the manner in which we share the Rosicrucian philosophy. It would probably be a very wise thing for all of us to ask ourselves very open, simple questions. Am I living a balanced life that is satisfying to my head and to my heart? Am I living a life that is feelingful as well as thoughtful? To say nothing of intuition. And when we try to share, are we sharing things in as simple of a way as possible? Now, these are really worthwhile questions to ask ourselves and to ask ourselves again and again. Sometimes every day in our retrospections. Now, some things are more difficult and some things are more complicated. And in order to share them or to expostulate them, we have to be a little bit more complicated. We know that from the cosmic conception. For as much effort that was put into the cosmic conception to keep it simple, it's a pretty challenging book. And Max Heindel didn't stint in his use of vocabulary. It sends you to the dictionary quite a bit. As long as we're bandying names about, let's be pretentious and quote Einstein. Einstein said everything should be made as simple as possible, but not more simple. If we simplify too much, we take away something that is essential, something that is necessary to the expression of truth. And when that happens, we just have thin generalizations. We have platitudes or something like that. So there is a danger of oversimplification. However, it seems that because we're insecure, or because we want to evade things, or because we really don't know, think we know who we are, or how much egoism we have, we complicate things in thinking that if they're more complicated, that we are more sophisticated people. Simplification should be one of our watchwords. Simplicity. Now, the reason for this long first introduction is that we're going to continue speaking about relationship of any kind of being with any other kind of being where we left off yesterday. We're going to look into the fix that we have gotten ourselves into. And we're going to look into the factors that led to us being in this fix. As we are doing that, I'm going to try to be as simple and appropriate as possible. One of the dangers of doing things this way is that it tends to lose people because it's too plain and too simple. And people think to themselves, I know this already, so this is just a waste of time. In some cases, that's true. In some cases, that hits the nail right on the head. But if it is plain truth about important matters, the repetition doesn't hurt us. In fact, it works its way deeper into our being. In many cases, repetition is more helpful than it is harmful. In our fallen state of consciousness, there is often too great of a differential between apparent knowledge and living knowledge. In my own experience of trying to live a higher life, a life that is consonant with the Rosicrucian philosophy, it's not so much a matter of what one knows or what one thinks one knows, it's a matter of what one can live. It is what we live that counts. We can only share truth, we can only realize truth or understand it in our own being according to the quality of our lives. So if you're somebody that thinks this is too simplistic and too plain spoken, I don't mind if you leave. And I don't mind even if you leave in your mind and tune me out. That's all right. Well, after all of that, it's probably wise to reorient and remember exactly where we were and what we're trying to do in these talks. It's easy in spiritual things because there is so much and it is so multifaceted to get distracted. And one distraction leads to another and to another, and pretty soon you're far away from where you intended to go. You've had a great trip. It's like a sightseeing trip. But this isn't just sightseeing. This is important stuff. And we have objectives to reach. Basically, in all five of these talks, we're trying to understand the structure, form, and workings of relationship. What makes them work and what makes relationships work well. We want to be able to do that in relation to any other being of any kind in the cosmos. We're not going to talk to fairies or anything like that. We could, but we will look into some of the principles that go into that kind of a relationship. We realize, as we did last evening when we talked about the fall of humanity, that we have sinned. It only takes a quick glance of human contribution to the environment versus natural contribution to the environment to see that our things stand out apart from nature in a quite a dreadful manner. We want to see things correctly. We want to see just how we are inharmonious with other creatures and creative beings. And we want to be able to correct our behavior in that. The hope, it may be a vain hope in these talks, is that if we see even a little bit of the nature of relationships and the divine intent for us in what we're all working together on, we can make corrections in ourselves and in our lives. Today is one of those grim days. We're going to look at the primary failure or the primary inhibition to healthy relationship. Tomorrow and the last 2 days beyond tomorrow, we're going to talk about specific kinds of relationships. Relationships with beings greater than us, relationships with beings lesser than us in evolutionary status, and relations with beings that are equal to us in evolutionary status. Now, toward the end of the talk last evening, it was noted that our humanity began its deviant course by rebellion, and that we went against divine intent that had been clearly given to us. From the Garden of Eden story, the scriptural description of it, it would seem that it happened in a day. Actually, it has been many thousands or many tens of thousands of years for our deviation to have gotten as severe as it is. So in these talks, we're trying to understand how our cosmic deviation relates to other beings. Not only just our own, but to others. We are co-evolving with many, many different varieties of beings. There is nothing in the cosmos that isn't living in some form or another. And our life in form and everything in our life in form is tied together with other beings. So it really is a wise thing to try and understand those. We said that the original, I hate to use the word, the original sin was a misuse of divine creative energy and a misuse of divine creative principles. The Lucifer spirits, as the story goes, gave us the hope of personal immortality. We were at that time awakening to awareness of our physical bodies. Consequently, we were also having a dim awareness of the loss of our physical bodies. And we shedded them from time to time in what we now call death, which was understood by us in a much different way at that time. Good evening. Even though we understood it in a different way, our personal knowledge of our bodies, along with that came identification. We were closing off the universal spiritual awareness and we were becoming more personally aware, and we began to identify with our bodies. And when we identify with something, there is attachment. And when there is attachment, especially when we are renegade and departing from spiritual unity, we become insecure. And when we become insecure, we grasp at things. And when we grasp at material things, we give them much more value than is appropriate. And we give them a kind of value that's sickly, that is not at all healthy. So with the awareness of death came an awareness of something to which we were attached. And this awareness of something that we were attached to certainly had to produce insecurity. Not a neurotic insecurity such as we have now, but very basic, fundamental, existential insecurity. Our consciousness at the time of the fall was innocent. It wasn't like we were nastily disobedient. It's that we were innocent and we listened to beings that it probably was not to our best to listen to. So when we started losing bodies and they were important to us and we were innocent, it must have been something like a very young child that has an owie. You know, a child will cry and they think it's the end of the world. You know, that this is my body, this is me, because little children don't know anything more than their body. We don't find many people, many three-year-olds, for example, having insecurities about their intellect. They're not even aware of it yet. Our outward consciousness, our waking self-consciousness, didn't span at that time the whole cycle of rebirth. So we saw things in an immediate sense. And so when the Lucifer said to us, you're losing bodies and we can teach you how you can replace them, it was not very hard to influence us. As we said last evening, they didn't lie. They only told us part of the truth. Previous to the inception of the increasing influence of the Lucifer spirits, what happened was we were guided in procreation by the angels and Jehovah. Inwardly, through an inner kind of consciousness, we were brought together at propitious times for procreative activities. And it was a rite It was a sacrament. It was a holy thing. There are still vestiges of this in historical times, that people treated mating in this same way. They did it as in harmony with the cosmos, and it was done in temples and things like that. Everything in our lives then was under the control of the divine hierarchies. They gave us exactly what we needed, when we needed it, and how we needed it. So our mind was much more undeveloped now. And because the mind was much more undeveloped, we couldn't understand the principle of harmony and cosmic relations. We could have some dim feeling of it, but it isn't like we try to understand it now. We didn't have the consciousness that we could feel almost anything in the cosmos. We didn't have the consciousness of the grand implications of everything that is in the cosmos. Now, since the spiritual self, our true spiritual nature, enters its personality, enters its vehicles of consciousness through the mind, it means that our personal sense of self and of self-assertion was very weak. It wasn't like somebody saying, I want this or I need this or something like that. Our selfness was very weak. We had to be led for our own good until we could develop more understanding so that we could volitionally and consciously act in harmony with the cosmos. So in those times, obedience was a virtue. And it was a very important virtue because our correct evolution depended on it. It's something like if you have a child or a pet and you're going down a busy traffic-filled street, you want that pet or that child to be obedient, so that it doesn't innocently go dashing off into traffic and end its stay here. That's one of the reasons why obedience is stressed so strongly in the Garden of Eden story. It was a critical and a very tenuous time. It's something like in a relay race. When the baton is being passed, that's the most critical time. Because it's so easy to drop it, or it's so easy to break pace and not be able to get back into your stride again. So it was an important time. Things were passing from the hierarchies to us. But what we did is we bolted ahead. The self was involved a little bit in the personality, enough to take the lead of the Lucifer spirits, and that was enough. Now, it's a little bit of a side trip, but once in a while we have to take a little side trip. We could ask ourselves questions about this whole business. If this story is true, why didn't the angels and the other divine beings stop the Lucifers? We do have stories of that very thing happening. We have stories of a war in heaven between the angels and the fallen angels. Divine beings do struggle for their place in the ongoing evolutionary work. But when they fight wars, they don't fight wars the way we do. In the first place, all divine creative beings, as part of their divinity, respect the divinity in others. It's a sign that we are not at all awakened if we don't respect the divinity in each and every person. Even if somebody is drunken and bellicose and seems not worthy of anything, it is a sign of our not being evolved if we don't respect the fact that in there somewhere is a being that is capable of knowing the truth and of being something wonderful. And if we pass judgment and saying that they aren't worthy of it, we are in fact harming them where we could help. Then there's the fact that divine beings, when they fight more with their character, with their nature. That is, they express love according to their creative abilities. They do things differently than we do. And so it's sort of like, you know, instead of trying to take over somebody who is refractory or recalcitrant or something like that, instead of trying to take over their life, if we keep giving to them and giving to them something positive, we hope to influence them. Not by saying you can't do this and throwing all kinds of no's out. You hope to bring the positive out of them. That's what the whole idea of looking for the good is. It's fostering the better part of a being that is evolving rather than trying to curtail a part that is not responding the way we would like it to. And we have to also remember that the Lucifers were also somewhat of an anomaly in the cosmic plan. There was no place given for the Lucifers, and they had a fend for themselves. And they were not at the time where they could greatly change the whole nature of the cosmos when they fell from grace, or when they did not allow wisdom to flow through them in favor of dealing with divine power in a magical, creative way. So the Lucifers worked outside of the cosmic standard. Love is always going to work. And the application of the angels and archangels and other divine beings of love to the condition of the Lucifers. In fact, our love for the Lucifers is going to be an important part of their redemption. So it's not a matter of saying, hey, you can't do that. That's the way human beings do. We become very arbitrary and say, you can't do that. So the angels couldn't do that with the Lucifers, nor could the archangels or anyone else. In any case, the Lucifers had their way over a long enough time so that by our following their tutelage, we deviated the path of evolution. And we talked about that last night. We came into greater materialism. We hardened the world and we lost our ability to have vision into the spiritual worlds. And we're left in a place where we are now. We are sort of flailing around in the dark and flailing under the impulse of desire, which those beings love enormously. And the more that we express desire and etheric energy in the ways that they like, the more they can harvest the experience, because that is more harmonious to their being. So we talked last night about the sins of Adam and Cain, the first and second sins, the sins of sex and violence. Jeez, I'm sounding almost like a minister. Frightening. From this, it seems obvious that ignorance and fear are near the root of our cosmic deviation. And it is that fear and ignorance that brings us into bad relationships with other beings. It's not just enough that we produced a hardness that is very hard to work through, and that we work in such a way that we have to learn everything by experience rather than by spiritual wisdom and experience combined. It's that we have messed up our relationship with all the beings that we could have a helpful or a co-helpful interaction with. We were urged to divine disobedience, and to divine governance, and we fell into the glamour presentation of we're going to make gods out of you. Basically, we selfishly sought immortality. If we look in the creature state, the state of animals and plants, there is no sense of self. If we look in the divine beings beyond us in evolution, there is a sense of self, but it is subsidiary to the higher sense of universal spiritual sharing. But in this, the attention was turned on us in such a way that we became selfish. And we selfishly wanted immortality. Now, it's not the same kind of selfishness as the Goldman Sachs bankers. That came much later. Eventually, we selfishly sought pleasure. We could pleasure ourselves, not just enjoy and appreciate things, but to indulge ourselves in pleasure, thinking, I need this, without realizing the consequences of that. When we did that with regard to the creative function, we didn't become immediately pornographic and kinky kinds of people. That also came much later. See, what happens is we started an arc that goes down deeper than the arc was originally intended to go down. We also sought power to control our lives, if for no other reason but to pleasure ourselves. At first, it was a kind of magical power because we still had that ability. We hadn't yet turned the sexual energy down so much that we had lost all magical ability and even that we had lost all of clairvoyance. It wasn't like shutting your eyelids, like one moment you see and the next moment you don't see. This is all a gradual process. What I'm trying to say is that we were not then monsters of selfishness, and that we were hugely discordant and antisocial in our behavior. It's probably even now part of us. It certainly is part of us now, but it is not that we are monsters of selfishness. And if we don't believe we don't have any selfishness to us, then why, if there is so much pain and suffering in the world, haven't we unfolded the divine ability to heal and to change things for the better? The obvious answer is that we cannot be trusted with magical healing powers because of our natures. The Elder Brothers and other mystery schools and divine beings would very gladly share that with us because they're much more keenly aware of the suffering that's going on than we are. That's one of the things. We have become so hardened, so inured, that we don't feel the suffering that we cause and the suffering that is all around us. If we did, we would probably be much more strongly motivated to live better lives. This is something that we have to realize in ourselves, that we all have some degree of selfishness, and anything that I'm saying about humanity applies equally well to myself. I don't have any super or paranormal powers, and that's the reason why. I can't be trusted with them. I haven't unfolded the soulfulness for all of that yet. Selfishness is clearly a very strong negating force to harmonious co-evolutionary relationship. If one's intent is selfish, there is no regard for others except what they can do for us or how we can take advantage of them. There's a lot of illusion and denial about this in the world. There are people who believe things can proceed as smoothly with selfishness as they can with loving cooperation. One example is traffic. And I've seen it. There are some places where they believe that it's every man for himself. And that if you let the highways run that way, things will go smoothly because everybody will know that everybody else is equally selfish and they aren't going to be able to get away with something because the next person's going to not allow that to happen. To some extent, it works. I've seen it work. In some places, like in Colombia, they don't have traffic patrolmen. I've yet to see a traffic patrolman out of all the many times that I've been out on the highways there. They don't have it. And they don't have stoplights. They have a few, but they have those traffic circles. And it's really interesting. There is a lot of communication, which leads toward coevolution, but it's a communication of how much can I get away with in this. But ultimately, if the selfishness persists, and we get stronger in our selfishness, and we get more competitive, it results to something that is calamitous. A complete selfishness doesn't work. There's no possible way it can work. There are different degrees of selfishness, and this differential of degrees of selfishness in itself means that it would have to fail. And even if it did work, to what end would it work? Our selfish ends are really pretty puny. The cosmos is one. We are part of that one. Our whole being is imbued and pervaded by the spiritual one. And the more we work into selfish ends, the more we become petty and small-minded, and it's actually silly. At least that's what it is to me when I look at myself. And I see some of the things I try to do and accomplish. It's funny that we can be so small-minded about things. Self-orientation in the unified spiritual thing that the cosmos is a form of suicide. It's a form of self-punishment, not a form of self-reward. And we are the only beings that believe in punishment. Now, this is said because of the Rosicrucian philosophies, and philosophies like the Rosicrucian philosophy, the mystery schools, are not the only philosophies in the world. And they're certainly not the most predominant philosophies in the world. There are philosophies such as objectivism. In objectivism, selfishness is a virtue. It is the prime virtue. It's a perfect example of that. It's an outright materialistic philosophy that believes everyone can end up wealthy if we are selfish. It's a prosperity philosophy. And it isn't only in objectivists. We find it in places like the Church of the Chain Letter or in Ponzi schemes or all of those kinds of things. The whole idea is everybody can make it. You know, this is what, like that we're destroying the rainforests. People cut down virgin forests that have never been harvested before. They don't even care about the wood. They let it rot or let it burn. They just clear the land, and then they get a few very good crops, and then the land is played out because rainforest soil is very, very thin. And it's a selfish thing, but then they just go on and clear the land in another place. This is why it's very important that we eat organic bananas more than almost any other organic fruit, because the way commercial bananas are grown, they're grown to get the maximum production of them, and when the soil is played out, there is no topsoil left. And where there has been a banana plantation, it's like an airport runway. It's all just hard soil, and nothing can grow on there for a long, long time. However, with organic bananas, it's not the same thing. You got to put a plug in for organic bananas. I'm sort of a banana freak. I could almost live off of bananas. Now, it's true that things are as they are now because we have made them that way. We've put ourselves in that fix. And we have to live within that reality. And to some extent, we do have to, at this time, look out for ourselves a little bit if we continue to go on. But if we follow the Christ path, little by little, more by more, we have to forego taking care of ourselves, even if it means that we get hammered more. But we have to make that jump. We can't wait till everybody else does it. It is our responsibility to go to the Christ-like way of living in the cosmos. Now, our selfishness and our self-centeredness is only a minor phase in evolution. We have made it more major than it really is, but it's a minor phase and a perverted one at that. There is great purpose to the cosmos. There is divine purpose. And we are all part of that divinity. And if we look inside of ourselves, as we do sometimes when we're very, very lucky to get an intuitive impulse, we can see that there is a purpose to it all. And that we're very lucky to be a part of that purpose. That it's really a wonderful thing to say, I belong, and that I belong to something else. The sooner we awaken to that and live accordingly, the better it'll be for all. And that's important. We don't seek spiritual enlightenment so we can have all those good feelings. We seek it so that others can have good feelings. It is the Christ way that we don't live for ourselves, but that we live for others. It was like Gertrude Stein says, well, you have to take it further than she took it. She says, I am because my cat loves me, is a way that you know that you exist. We would say, I am because you are loved. We will only know ourselves in a healthy way when we're loving others. That is a kind of healthy self-initiative. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy, in it we learn about the law of attraction and repulsion in the desire world. And according to that principle, if we give of ourselves relative to an object or to another being, we activate the force of attraction. Everybody wants to be around somebody who is giving because it's just pleasant. They're attracted to us. By the same principle, when we assert ourselves relative to some object or some being, we try to take something to ourselves, we activate the force of repulsion. We push others away. Nobody wants to be around the selfish person. The motive for self-assertion is the object. To of an object is selfishness. The reason we assert ourselves and repel each other and do not work in harmonious relationship is because we are selfish. We know that we can do things for ourselves, so we do them, even though it repels us from the others that we need and that we are bound together with for all of eternity. When it works with attraction and repulsion, it isn't something moralistic. It isn't like God has pointed out and is going to make an example of us and is going to punish us. Punishment is only a human creation. It is that the consequence of selfish self-assertion is the very nature of the principle. It is that which separates us. We know this, but we don't always live by it. We have statements that shows us that this is true. We say there is no honor among thieves. It's like the cowboy movie where the desperados have got all the loot, and they figure they'll have more loot if they kill one another off, until finally they all have done each other off, and then the posse comes riding up and doesn't even have to do any fighting. Selfishness isn't merely limited to the desire which impels selfish action. There are problems of selfishness that transcend the desire world on the mental level, and they also impede healthy, harmonious, loving relationships with others. They impede progress. If we look astrologically, selfishness and ignorance and separation are all ruled by Saturn. Through Capricorn, which is ruled by Saturn, Saturn abstractly rules the 10th house. The 9th house is a Jupiterian house. It is a house of proportion. And you get the 9th house feeling when you walk out on a starry night and you look into the heavens and you see how vast it all is. And that's much enhanced now that we know from astronomy the things that we know. We get a sense of proportion and we see how small we are. We have some Eastern astrologers here. The 9th house is the house of Dharma. It's things that puts things into proportion by seeing the relative size of things. The 10th house is the house of perspective. And perspective is how we see things. It is our individual personal slant on life. If we see things only from our own perspective, we tend to enter into that Saturnine consciousness. Because the more we see them only from our own perspective, the less able we are to see them from the perspective of someone else. And there's not one perspective that's more important than another. Every perspective has its right. Obviously, if we're only seeing things from our perspective, this obviates the need for any other point of view. And that thwarts a healthy relationship with others because we don't respect the need for them. I've got the slant on life. I don't need to hear from you. You're just bothering me. You're just distracting me. In effect, that's what we're saying when we do things that way. I've tried looking for a few years, and what I have noted is there is not a single incidence of trying to look at things from the perspective of another that has ever done anything to harm my own perspective. In fact, it only enhances it. enlarges it and takes in more. There is no reason why we need to look at things only from our way. We can even stay with our own perspective and our own opinion about it if we take into account what it does for others and we see that it doesn't harm either them or us. There's a lot to say for the Jesus people who wear the buttons WWJD, where they ask, what would Jesus do? Because they benefit from that and they know they benefit from it. Unfortunately, they think it is a personal revelation from Christ, but what it is, it's just a fact of nature. It doesn't even have to be from Jesus' point of view. It's probably much healthier if it's from the point of view of the person that you're arguing with. The points of view of the people that we are in constant relationship with, those are the important ones. So it follows from all of this that from our self-centered take on life, it's keeping us away from a bigger, broader language. Because when we see something the way someone else sees it, as well as the way we see it, we rise above it. We transcend. And we can see things in a larger sense. We even have things where we say we have risen above petty differences. And that's exactly what happens. Another point of view is a point of view taken from someone else's experience, and their experiences might be helpful to us. So it is a very important thing that it's not just selfishness that I want this, but that we actually see in our consciousness what others are seeing in their consciousness, because that is what leads us to the greater consciousness that we all share. Well, after all this selfishness talk, it's now time for a correction. It's like that. You want to make a point and you start pounding your fist in your hand, and pretty soon you've gone off too far and you have to make a correction. When we began, we said that this was going to be simple. And it really is simple. We haven't said anything here that anybody doesn't understand and doesn't understand from their own experience. I'm just the one that is the reminder tonight. This might even sound a little crude and a little coarse in order to make a point, and it is that. From what has been said, you could almost think that we as human beings are outright demons of selfishness. It's true that we have done some horribly selfish things, and that we still do some things like that to each other. But most of us, most of the time, are striving to be better beings. And for most human beings, more of their consciousness is spent in unselfish things than in selfish things. That doesn't mean that we're selfless, or that we're self-forgetting, or that we're self-sacrificing, but it does mean that we put more into that. As spiritual students, we're striving to grow. And when we do so, we uncover all kinds of subtle forms of egoism. Even little things are a big help, and we progress a lot. There's a lot of our being of which we are unconscious. And in that unconsciousness is where a lot of the subtleties lie. The spiritual path is an increasingly subtle path. It becomes more and more subtle all the time, and instead of expecting fireworks and fanfares and things like that with regard to the spiritual worlds, we expect something more subtle. Not getting all excited, but being able to see through things more easily. People who are experts in maintaining harmonious relationships know and develop this in their consciousness. For example, we have diplomats, and diplomats may have to deal with very horrible conditions and differences with other countries, but when they do that, if they're going to make any progress at all, they have to do it with subtlety. So in correction, we have to say that it is not wise to look too much at selfishness, because that can become an end in itself, and we can become selfish about selfishness. If we do that, anything we give our attention to strengthens it. It happens. I've been trying at this now for almost 50 years, and there are times that I think it's futile, because I'm never going to do it because it's so hard. And if I look back on those times, it's always because I've made it that way. I've made it that way by giving too much attention to things, and they become magnified. They become worse than they really are. Again, if we go right back to the simple things and think one thought at a time and hold fast to holding positive, good thoughts, no matter how insurmountable something is, it can be overcome. So even though for the sake of understanding what we're dealing with, we have had to speak about selfishness, we can't give it so much power that we subsume our own ability to do anything about it. We do get things right once in a while. So if we strive to do the right things and we get things right, we'll learn about all the selfishness in proper time. It's like playing a piece of music. If you're getting the piece of music right and all the chords and notes are coming out right, when you hit a clinker, there's no doubt about it. And if you're trying to live in love and harmony and you do something that isn't there, you've hit your moral clinker, you'll know right away. You don't have to say, well, am I thinking about selfishness too much? You know, it just comes. The light of harmony, or the light that pervades harmony, is plenty sufficient for us. Our fall was an act or an assertion of divinity. In awareness of that, it is wise to continue in divinity. We are divine beings, and we are ultimately parts or facets or spirits within spirit of a divine spiritual being that we all share. The more we strive to unfold and build our true nature, our spiritual nature, the more we're going to harmonize. And we'll humbly let go of our selfishness. We won't have to focus on it, because then it becomes a curse to us. Until then, selfishness and ad harmony will be increasingly painful to us. It's like Paul says, it's hard to kick against the thorns. You can't do it for long. You know right off where that leads you. It is the purpose of these talks to introduce the topic and not to solve it in so many words. It has to be solved by living. And even the way that we're looking at it is very simple, to the point of simplistic. We can't be thorough, we can't be comprehensive, and we can't be exhaustive, because if we were, I would be exhausted if I were even capable of doing it at all. So we have not explained a lot of things, and we have not looked at a lot of things. We've not looked at the concurrent misdevelopment of the mind and its contribution to the problem. We have not looked into the positives and negatives that come with our blindness. Because our being blind to the spiritual world isn't all bad. There are some very good things about it. We haven't looked into the fact that there are a lot of other factors that inhibit beyond selfishness. We just stated a really simple thing. We looked at the most simple and the most pervasive inhibitor to healthy relationship. The purpose of these talks, as far as I'm concerned, is not to impart information. Information can be helpful, or it can actually block development. You can't teach spiritual development like you teach arithmetic. It is something that you can get the ideas or the principle can be communicated, but it is only in the living. And the living, in order for it to be true at all, especially if we are trying to live in the Christ, has to be spontaneous. The value in these summer schools is showing how the Rosicrucian philosophy helps us and we help each other to live better lives, to live more harmonious lives. A talk like this is successful if each one of us examines the common reasons for the fix that we find ourselves in, or if we have discord in our lives, what have we done to contribute to it? In that, you all know that I love gardening and I love to see things grow, but it's nothing compared to loving to see the way people grow. And if talks like this help even in a little bit for people to live better lives, I will be very, very happy. All right, now we're ready to proceed forward in future talks. Next time we're going to speak about one of the three basic relationships that are possible. And for now, we will close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Don't understand how they.
We ask if anybody is interested in going to this tomorrow to please sign because we're, you know, be very helpful if we know how many were coming.
Richard, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
The Lucifer's told the developing spirits that they could have immortality if they procreated.
Yes.
But procreation invites other spirits. It isn't a procreation.
Yes, but that was the way that it was given to us. It was obviously not intended to educate us. It was intended to miseducate us. And in that miseducation, all the other beings that worked in harmony with the whole process that was going on didn't know how to work outside of that harmony. But because the Lucifers themselves had done their deviation, they knew how to work outside of it and to take advantage of it. That's not to say that they're the only beings that have inimical effects on us. There are other beings, But for what we're trying to do here, we're trying to get at the root of where we started in our deviant path. It's important that we talk about them first, or centralize on them.
What does it mean that our love for the Lucifers will also help them?
Because they have formed a relationship with us. And when we are redeemed and when we raise ourselves, automatically, since it's a two-way street, what comes from us goes to them. And it's a possibility that through us that they can be reincorporated, because we have taken this deviant path. We have to make a more extreme effort to complete the evolution. In that extreme effort, we lose some along the way, which wasn't intended, but in that extreme effort, there more is gleaned out of the experience, because it's a harder kind of experience, and from that greater experience, that goes automatically to the Lucifers, and they don't harvest just the dross of our experience, they harvest the better part as well, and that can very much be the part that redeems them with us. It's sort of like we might drag them along with us, because they're attached with us, to us, and they have to go where we go, and that sounds like a pretty good deal. We can do it, but we can't take pride and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to save me a Lucifer. That's, you lost right there already.
Now, doesn't Lucifer come from the word for light?
Yes.
These very high light-being angels?
Yes.
That led this rebellion?
Yes, it was a false light. It was a false light that was enough to be a clever imitation.
Oh.
So that people, you know.
So, like the Antichrist is supposed to be kind of a clever imitation.
I don't know what to say about that. I don't have a comment at this moment on that topic. No, we're not bringing somebody new. We're just providing new bodies. That was part of the story. Yes. In fact, there was a separation of the ways. Adam and Eve had three sons, Cain, Abel, and Seth. And Cain was supposedly, according to the myth, the son of Eve and the Lucifer spirit, semi-divine. And the children of fire, or the spiritual Freemasons, come from Cain. Seth is the result of the union of Adam and Eve. And so that is called the Son of Man. So if you run into the Son of the Widow anywhere in the Bible, you're speaking about the Lucifers. Whereas if you run into the words the Son of Man, Old Testament or New Testament, you're talking about the ones that the children of Seth, or the children of water. The children of Abel are those that never fell. And they stayed in the ethers, and they only on very rare occasions do they make a sacrifice to come here and help us out. But they didn't need to, because they didn't fall for it, so to speak. They're like the beings that are human beings that are associated with most of the other planets. They are in the ethers and not in the physical, or at least not as much in the physical as we are.
So it's the idea to try to lead the best life you can to avoid that set of problems?
In a simple way, yes. But the thing about it is, it's good to start simple and stay simple, because you'll get all the complexity that you need as things come up. You know, Monty Python did a thing once where they did a take on Robin Hood, only Robin Hood, instead of stealing money, stole lupins, which are flowers. And After a while, all kinds of complexities set into what they were doing, because they were stealing flowers from some people and giving them to other people. And what came of that was, one of the Robin Hood figures was saying, this redistribution of the wealth is a pretty complicated situation. And if you try to help people in the simplest way possible, not just helping little old ladies across the street, but people come to you and they have problems, and you try to solve them in the simplest way possible, it gets pretty hairy sometimes, and you get led into all the complexity that you need. You don't have to manufacture the complexity or set out with a great scheme of complexity. It comes along of its own record, of its own accord, and when it does, it is a better amount rather than if you artificially produce a complexity in the first place.
So the idea is to keep it simple?
As much as possible. Yes.
So it was very interesting yesterday today how, you know, I hit this thing because I obviously turned the wrong way on the note of there, not knowing it. I thought I wasn't there yet. And then when I finally came to a spot to turn, it was right in front of a house of a man who was cutting the grass that used to work at that Volvo place. And he changed the tire and put the spare tire on and explained why the thing still said you need air, because the thing, the computer thing is sitting in the back of my car still saying it needs air, and it's going to flash this all the way back. So yeah. I really need to get it taken. But I mean, how many places could this have happened?
Yeah.
To be right by somebody that could help me.
But to answer your question in the simplest way that I can think of, it's a good way to start a retrospection every night to ask yourself one very simple question. Did you love today? And it's surprising sometimes how much we are preoccupied and we don't love. That's a good simple way to start things off. In fact, you could even... What?
Did you love what?
Did you love today? And you find out how many times you didn't love. You can go back through the whole day looking at, did I look at this with love or did I not look at this with love? All right.
Yeah. I told him he was my good Samaritan and my guardian angel. So hopefully, you know, he knew that I appreciated his help.